Okay, first question is about the minimum wage. That if the minimum wage had kept pace with productivity, it'd be around $21 an hour today. And then the second part, what should the minimum wage be? First point, not to be a nitpicky nerd, but the correct measure of productivity, and you have to be careful with it, I won't go into detail here, but if you do a proper measure of productivity for these purposes, it would be about $17 an hour. I'm sorry to make it lower, but it's important we be, if we're going to make a claim, we want it to be true. We aren't the couches, you know, so we have to get right. So what should it be? One of the things important to realize, the minimum wage used to keep pace with productivity growth. The person who wrote the question may have known that, but I think a lot of people didn't. I didn't realize that myself until a couple years ago. We first had national minimum wage, federal minimum wage in 38, and if you look from 38 to 68, the minimum wage tracked productivity very closely, basically because it tracked average wages, and those tracked productivity. We're now talking about 10-10 an hour, and the idea is that will restore the minimum wage to its 1968 purchasing power. But if we wanted to say, okay, suppose it kept pace with productivity growth, well, it'll be at 17 an hour. Now, does that mean we could raise the minimum wage to 17 an hour? I would say not right now, not quickly, not with other without other changes. So I say that. I think it is important to realize you can raise the minimum wage too much. You know, there's research, some of which has been done at my center, my colleague John Schmidt. There's research showing that the raises in the minimum wage we've seen have not led to unemployment. But for the most part, those were raises of 15, 20, 25%. If you talk about raising the minimum wage, you know, we're at $7.25 an hour. If you talk about raising it to $17 an hour, you talk about raising it like 130, 140%. I think that would lead to a lot of unemployment. And it's something that we have to be careful about for the simple reason we don't get to make mistakes. The other side gets to make mistakes all the time, and they just sweep them under the rug, and it's rude to ever talk about them. That's why Larry Summers is still a very prominent economist. But we don't have that luxury. So I think it is important, as much as I would like to see us raise the minimum wage as high as possible, and I would love to see it get back to 17 an hour, I don't think that could be done quickly. And again, we do need other changes, you know, something close to full employment. So raising the minimum wage in a context where the overall unemployment rate is 4%, I'd feel much better about than raising it in a context where, you know, it's 6.5% or 6.7% today and probably a couple percentage points higher if we look at all the people who've dropped out of the labor force. What about the effects of automation? I love this one. You know, I do a lot of work on Social Security. I get a kick out of this because it just shows how kind of out to lunch, you know, many people doing policy in Washington or writing on it are. I do a lot of work on Social Security, and the story you do work on Social Security is, oh my God, we have all these baby boomers who are going to retire, and there's not going to be anyone there to work. Okay, and what's the story of automation? We're going to have all the robots, there's not going to be any jobs. Okay, one or the other can conceivably be true. They cannot both be true. You know, and I kind of love Thomas Friedman, who I love to make fun of. He actually believes both are big problems. I'm serious. Well, I know what he believes. He writes that. But in any case, automation, you know, automation's productivity growth. You know, it doesn't matter whether they're robots or, you know, whatever we call it. It's productivity growth. Productivity growth has actually slowed in recent years, you know, since the downturn. And, you know, I'd actually like to see more rapid productivity growth. During the years, the golden age, you know, 47 to 73, we had much more rapid productivity growth than we've seen at any point since, even, you know, in the booming years of the 90s. We had about 3% a year annual productivity growth, whereas even the best years of the 90s, well, there might have been a year we had 3%, but the average was around 2.5, 2.6. So I'd love to see more rapid productivity growth. That should give us the opportunity to have higher incomes, higher standard of living, or work fewer hours. So I don't see that as a problem going together with good economic policy. As it is, though, as I say, we haven't seen the good productivity growth. We've actually seen weak productivity growth. That may turn around. I mean, I know people are big, you know, fans of this, saying, oh, you know, it's just around the corner. We're going to have computer-driven cars. We probably will. I mean, I don't know how quickly, but, you know, I'm sure we will at some point. But, again, I'm a skeptic on that. I'm not, you know, there's the pessimists running around. We aren't going to have enough workers. I'm not one of those, but I'm also not one of these optimists or they might consider themselves pessimists who think that, you know, the robots are going to replace us all and, you know, we won't have jobs. Okay, this one's a question about economic and political feasibility of a basic income. or dropping Social Security and Medicare to age 55. I'd say the political feasibility of both those are pretty close to zero. There's a real ethic on work. I was on a panel or a phone conversation with someone talking about the idea of a basic income, and I just have to say, you look at things you want to push for, where do you really want to have a really big ideological fight? And I just wouldn't put it at basic income, because people sympathize with raising a minimum wage. Most Republicans support raising a minimum wage because you're talking about people working, so they could identify with that. You're going to work. You'll get more money. You work, but you'll get a decent pay. Saying that people should get money whether or not they work, I mean, it doesn't trouble me. We have a lot of rich people. It's very hard to see what they do that resembles work. But, am I going to have a big fight for it that will probably go nowhere? I guess maybe I've gotten old. I don't want to have a fight over principle. I want to have a fight that might actually accomplish something, and I just don't see that doing it. The other part, lowering the Social Security age, someone, Jamie Goldbratt, a friend of mine, was a big fan of saying during the downturn, we should have lowered Social Security, let people get at 62. I was not a big fan of that, and the simple reason was that we have a lot of people that retire early, overestimating their savings or underestimating their need for savings, however you want to put it, and they end up with not very good retirements. So unless it was coupled with some additional funding, so that means another step, I wouldn't favor doing that. So it's something you have to be, to my view at least, very careful about. I don't want to encourage people to retire earlier than they could afford to do that. So I would be hesitant on that. Lowering Medicare age, it might be interesting to talk about in the context of now that we have the exchanges. Can you talk about lowering Medicare? That might be possible. I mean, one of the things that, I think we, meaning progressives, should be thinking about now that we have the exchanges in place, how can you make these better? I'm not a fan of the insurance industry, but, I'm willing to believe you wouldn't have gotten, we were nowhere close to getting a universal Medicare system. As much as that might have been desirable, we were nowhere close. But now that you have the exchanges, well, one of the things that people point out, there's a lot of areas you could point to where there's just one or two plans. So what's wrong with saying, well, why can't Medicare offer a plan, in this part of West Virginia or wherever it might be? The private sector doesn't want to do it. So why don't we let the government do it? See how you could do, press that, see whatever you could do to expand the reach there. What accounts for... people who consistently vote against their own economic interest, and what is this responsible for the level of economic inequality today? I'd say a couple things about that. First off, I'm not a political scientist, so I'll take that one as an out, but obviously I've thought about this. Part of the story, I have to tell people, I can't always tell them they're voting against their own economic interest. Mentioning trade a moment ago. Well, President Obama's pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Trans-Atlantic Trade and Investment Pact. Bill Clinton put in NAFTA. Larry Summers and Robert Rubin raised the value of the dollar. In many ways, of course, Democrats are going to be better, but there are a lot of bad things you could point to that Democrats have done when they've held power. So. It does make it a harder story to tell. I wish we could have said that, President Obama, when we got in, he was going to beat up the bankers and throw them in jail. Didn't touch them, and we should just be clear, I'll digress a moment because I think it's important. He could have prosecuted these people, just to be clear, I don't mean you go into Goldman Sachs and you arrest Lloyd Blankfein. You start at the bottom up. What you had here were a lot of fraudulent mortgages that people knew were fraudulent mortgages because they were totally bogus. And, anyone who's ever bought a home, you got to dot every I, cross every T, go through everything, show all this stuff. These mortgages, that was not done. Okay, and everyone knew that. They had things filled in, things not filled in. Everything's in, numbers crossed out, other numbers put in. A lot of the cases, someone comes in, wants to borrow $400,000. What's your income? $50,000. Well, you can't borrow $400,000 if your income's $50,000. So what happens? The loan officer writes $100,000. Okay, that happened a lot of cases. It wasn't one or two. It happened a lot of cases. Well, how do you prosecute this? You go to Countrywide, you find a lot of the bogus loans, you find the loan officer that made them. You go, you crossed out all these numbers. Why'd you do this? And you get a loan officer, you go, well, you want to go to jail? You want to tell us why you did it? Well, our branch manager said that they wanted, X number of loans a week, and they didn't care how we did it. So you get two or three or four loan officers who say, yeah, that's what the branch manager told us. And then you go to the branch manager, you go, well, we got two or three or four of your loan officers who say you want so many loans a week and you didn't care how they did it. You know, why did you decide that was a good thing to do? And, you know, presumably some of them around go to jail will say, oh, well, that's the orders from headquarters. Okay, so I don't know if that means you get Angela Mozilla or not, but you're probably going to get some pretty big fish over at headquarters. And same thing with the investment banks. You know, you had Wells Fargo and Morgan Stanley and the rest, Goldman Sachs. They aren't stupid people. They're seeing these mortgages. They know they're garbage. And we have some emails on this. I mean, it's not, you know, my wishful thinking. They're not stupid people. They knew they were passing along garbage. So again, you ask them why, you know, you're supposed to be putting good mortgages in. You knew these were garbage. And, you know, again, you go, why do you, you know, where'd you get this idea that, you know, it was a good thing to throw in these garbage mortgages and these mortgage-backed securities? You know, and they never did anything like that. And, you know, I have a friend, Bill Black, some of you might have heard of him, he writes, you know, to different places, Huffington Post. He was in, I'm going to have to remember this at some point, the Oversight Administration for the Savings and Loan. They no longer exist, but he was in that in the 80s, and he led the prosecution of a number of savings and loans, most importantly, Charles Keating at Lincoln Savings. Keating, who recently died, by the way, I should point, it was in the news recently. And, you know, I asked him, I bumped into him when we were at something not too long after Obama came to the White House, I think it was February of 2009. I said, well, anyone in the Obama administration been in touch with you? You know, because, you know, if you wanted to clean up Wall Street, this is a guy you'd want. I mean, he's got the experience, he's a smart guy, you know, he knows how to do it. And he just laughed. No one called him, no interest, you know. So anyhow, so if we think about, you know, the Democrats, you know, being more for the interest of workers, yes, you know, the Affordable Care Act was a great thing. Would the Republicans have passed the stimulus? I don't know. You know, I don't know what they'd have done. I'm hesitant to say they'd have done nothing. I don't think they'd have done nothing. I don't know what they have done. But I think it's easy to see someone who's not very political going, well, you're giving me these Wall Street guys, you know, Robert Rubin and, you know, the rest. Why should I believe them? So I could certainly understand that cynicism. You know, again, that's not the whole story. I understand, you know, going on about gay, lesbian rights and this and that. You know, there are all these other issues. But I think part of it really is that people could look at the Democrats and say, well, it's not clear they represent me either. Okay, that's an easy one. Is Paul Krugman right in his columns? I'll say a little bit about, I've had interesting experiences with Paul Krugman over the years. I first came to Washington, I was at the Economic Policy Institute, and we were regularly at war with Paul Krugman. Back then, Paul Krugman was much more in the center. I think he saw it as his job to sort of police the left. You know, we were clearly to his left, and there were any number of issues that, you know, he criticized us on. I will say that in almost every case, he was wrong and we were right. But, you know, the last decade or so, I consider him a great ally. I mean, and, you know, I get scared. My wife says we're actually the same person, because there have been any number of times that I write something and then I go to his column and he's written the same thing. In fact, he did that once, because we referred to the same obscure piece. You know, I said, did you just write this? And he said, oh, yeah, I should have given you credit. He had seen my blog. Because I was going, like, you could not have just gone to this at the same time. So I think Krugman's moved hugely and, you know, really all for the good. He's, obviously a very prominent economist, has a great platform both with his blog and his columns in the Times. And, you know, he's still, it's funny on trade, because he's moved hugely on trade. And, you know, one of the areas that I'll take a little credit for with Krugman, he wrote something on the Trans-Pacific Partnership where he kind of trivialized it, saying that, you know, people are making a big deal out of it, it's not really a big deal. So I sent him a note saying, no, I think it actually is a big deal, you know, because one of the points he was making is absolutely right on. The trade barriers between us and these countries are already very low. So, you know, the idea, if anyone thinks that, oh, my God, we're going to be flooded with cheap imports from, you know, the countries, it's silly. The trade barriers are already very low. So if there are going to be cheap imports from, you know, Thailand or they're already here. You know, they're not being kept out. But what these deals are about is they're about setting up a regulatory structure that's very pro-business. You know, it's almost certain the case. I mean, it's secret, so we don't know it's there. Everyone's going, what are you so excited about? Well, we don't know what's there. You know, this is, you know, the idea is they're going to come up with this finished pack. Congress is going to have, I forget whether it's 30 days, you know, whatever it would be under fast track authority. and be up or down vote, and every lobbyist in the country is going to be running around there with their pockets full of money saying, you better vote for this. You know, you do, you'll get the money. You don't, it goes to your opponent. So that's the plan. And, you know, it's likely to have restrictions on our ability to put in environmental regulations, other types of health and safety regulations. One of the things clearly is front and center there is we want to raise the price of prescription drugs. There's all these provisions. WikiLeaks, they leaked the intellectual property chapter, and it's got all these provisions that would raise the price of prescription drugs, mostly in other countries, but also over the longer term, and probably affect us as well. So, you know, I sent a note to Krugman. I said, I think this is a big deal. And he then later took that back and he wrote, yeah, you know, he said we shouldn't be doing these deals because it's not, these aren't good for, you know, they're not about trade and they're not good for the country. So I give Krugman, I'd say from going from being 30 to 40% right, probably about 90, 95% right. So I don't know if he scores me the same way. student loan bubble. These are good questions. Okay, so what about the student loan bubble? Have student loans depressed the economy? You know, people refer to it as a bubble. And let me just say, you know, I was the bubble person talking about the stock bubble, talking about the housing bubble. It's not really a bubble for the simple reason it can't collapse at the same time. Stock bubble and housing bubble had a particular logic. My loan depended on your loan in the sense that, you know, if you go back to the housing bubble, the value of my house depend on the value of everyone else's house. My house price wasn't going to fall on its own. You know, if I really damaged it, of course it would. But I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't going to fall on its own. It fell because everyone else's house price fell. So once that wave of credit, you know, the bubble credit stopped, everyone's house price fell together. So in that sense, you had a bubble. You know, everything collapsed. Student loans, you go, what would happen? You know, say you have all these students out there, and this isn't to say they aren't a big burden. They are. But you have all these students out there. How are the loans going to collapse together? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So it's not a bubble in that way, you know, so it's not a bubble. Now, is it depressing the economy? Sure, you know, it's you have a lot of people that, you know, otherwise would have more money in their pocket, would be able to spend more, and they're not able to do it. So you have people getting out of college with $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in debt. That certainly depresses their spending. Now, the aggregate impact on the economy, I have to say, probably is not that large, but there's no doubt it's a dampening effect. I to be honest, though, I think the more serious thing is, you know, you got a lot of people that are going to have to really struggle in life. You know, if they're coming out of college with $30,000, $40,000 in debt and poor career prospects, I mean, you have people come out of Harvard Business School with, you know, $100,000 in debt. I'm not too worried about them. You know, they'll make twice that their first year out. But a lot of people, you know, their job opportunities in this economy are pretty bad. So, you know, if you have $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in debt and you're lucky to get a job that pays you $30,000, that's a pretty bad story. So it is a big problem. I think it's not a bubble story, but I think it is a big problem. Okay, two more. I had a question that someone was going to ask me on growth, and I don't know if I've found it here, but I'll answer that, about sustainable economy and growth. I talk a lot about growth and getting back to full employment, and people often put that as being opposed to the idea of having a sustainable economy. I guess I don't for a couple reasons. First off, we're not going to get to a sustainable economy by having a lack of growth. In other words, the idea that if, you know, we just stagnated, somehow we'll be better. I mean, I understand, you know, if we snapped our fingers and, you know, the Congressional Budget Office puts us 6% below potential GDP. So if we snapped our fingers and, you know, we're at potential GDP, sure, we'd have more greenhouse gas emissions, no doubt about that. But we still have plenty today. And I think what we have to think about is how do you get on a path where we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in a really big way? Well, asking people, you know, you look at the policies that would do that, well, some of that should be associated with stimulus, you know, building, more fuel-efficient housing, energy-efficient housing, trains, you know, all these things like that. That would be a path to a more sustainable economy. That's associated with more growth, not less. Also, if you talk about, you know, and I do think we have to do this, taxing fossil fuels, taxing carbon emissions, that's not popular. People aren't going to like that. You know, they'll never like that. But people will be much more accepting of seeing their gas go up, you know, 30, 40, 50 cents a gallon if they have a good-paying job that they're secure in and they're getting pay increases every year than if, you know, they're worried they could lose their job tomorrow and they haven't had a pay increase in two decades. Okay, so I think a context in which, you know, we have a full employment economy is one where we could talk about making those changes. Now, further down the road, you know, can we talk about one that, you know, a clean economy? I think there's enormous potential, you know, without sort of radical view, you know, I mean, very happy for all sorts of futuristic things that may turn out, you know, where we could, you know, have totally clean economy, zero emissions, that sort of thing. But technologies that we already have and are very close to being economically competitive with fossil fuels, we could lead to very large reductions in emissions. And some of the things are simple. I mean, you know, one of the things that amazes me, buses. I don't understand why we don't talk about buses. Maybe it's because I take the buses to work, you know, but it's, you know, this is old technology, about as old as it gets, you know, and you have bus lanes and you had free buses. A lot of people would take them, I think. Be a big thing for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Another thing, you know, I was mentioning about reducing work time, big fan of 4-day work week. You know, if people only have to commute, you know, 4 days a week rather than five, you've reduced the emissions in their commuting by 20%. You know, if you could reduce traffic jams even more. So there's a lot of things we could do that will reduce emissions. I don't think anything is going to happen overnight, but I think we do have a path there if we take it. And I think we're more likely to take that if we talk about that in the context of being somewhere near full employment where people aren't worried about, you know, being able to pay their rent or mortgage and putting bread on the table. Okay, let me quickly find one last one. Oh, beautiful. What can young college graduates do to change the conversation in this country regarding economic policy to focus on stimulus, full employment, and trade deficit? I wish I had a good answer to that one. I have a guy who's been harassing me for a year, 2 years, probably longer, saying, you know, you got to write the definitive piece that explains to people how deficits, you know, are good for the economy. We do have to explain that to people, and it really is striking. The amount of, I don't know if ignorance is the right word, because I don't mean to, you know, imply people are stupid or anything, but the misunderstanding about the economy. And, you know, I could understand the misunderstanding, because we all know, look, you know, we all know if we run up a bill of $1,000 every month on our credit card, we get in trouble. You know, we all understand that. And everyone is thinking, oh my God, the government's running up, you know, trillions of dollars, which, you know, again, people have no idea how big the economy is. So it could always scare someone, $1 trillion. And there's a whole industry in Washington that does exactly that. Trillion with a T. I don't know how many times I've heard that, you know, just in case you don't know how to spell. You know, and this is where the economics profession has failed enormously, because it really would be nice if economists could agree and go, okay, look, here's the story. I mean, this isn't new. I mean, Keynes wrote about it, you know, 80 years ago now almost. It's not a new story. You know, that, you know, in you have a down economy, you need to have a source of stimulus because of the private demand, you need a source of spending because the private sector isn't doing it. And, you know, the problem that I think is analogous to, we all believe, maybe someone's going to raise their hand and say they don't, but I'm willing to accept that we all believe that the Earth goes around the sun. Okay, now we could get out there and see the sun go around the Earth. Any fool could see that, right? You know, it goes from east to west. We could all see that. Why do we believe that the Earth goes around the sun? Because every astronomer in the world says the Earth goes around the sun. And they have a clear explanation for it, and we could listen and understand that to greater or less extent. But every astronomer in the world agrees that the Earth goes around the sun. No dispute. Okay, well, in economics, okay, we all know that it's bad for us to borrow. Now, is it good for the government? Well, there's a lot of economists. Some of them have Nobel Prizes. You know, they're professors at the University of Chicago, Minnesota, other prestigious places. They go, no, government, you know. So I think that's really the problem we have to overcome. And, you know, whether that's dishonesty on their part or God knows what, I don't know. But I think it makes it a really big problem. And I think it really is a very fundamental issue, because until people understand that, it is very, very hard to change it. And, you know, there's a huge amount of suffering because of it. So as I say, I wish I had a good, simple answer. I don't. I mean, I have some ideas. But, you know, it is really important that we educate people because, you know, we, the country, the world, is paying an enormous cost. So I'll stop with that. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dean Baker speaking on Unemployment and Inequality, A Path Forward, held on April 4th, 2014, and sponsored by the Madison Institute. For free downloads of Dean Baker's books, go to the Center for Economic Policy and Research website at www.cepr.net. CEPR.net. To listen to more thought-provoking programs sponsored by the Madison Institute, go to our website at www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the sponsors.